Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Marco Meglio, editor with Neurology Live. In this episode, Dr. Scott Grossman, assistant professor of neurology and ophthalmology at the NYU Grossman School of Medicine, joins us to discuss emerging research on inter-eye retinal nerve fiber layer asymmetry as a biomarker of prior optic neuritis in pediatric onset multiple sclerosis. Drawing from data presented at the 2026 AAN annual meeting, Grossman explains how OCT imaging may help improve diagnostic confidence and identify remote optic nerve injury in pediatric MS populations. Grossman also discusses the implications of the newly updated McDonald criteria, the feasibility of integrating OCT into clinical neurology practice, and future directions aimed at improving pediatric-specific biomarker interpretation and neuroaxonal monitoring in multiple sclerosis. Let's dive in.
So much of your audience will be aware that the diagnostic criteria for 2024 have been updated in a couple of important ways, including the optic nerve as a lesion site for multiple sclerosis. That's valuable because about 25% of people who develop MS will initially present with inflammation of the optic nerve. But prior to this updated version of the criteria, that would not have counted towards distribution in space for a diagnosis of multiple sclerosis. And as a result, some of those folks may be at a diagnostic disadvantage, may be exposed to a longer period of time without medication and therefore to greater neurologic disability. So the optic nerve became included as a lesion site, and it became important to emphasize how that would be defined, including by MRI, but we also have other paraclinical tests that we do as neuro-ophthalmologists that measure the function and structure of the optic nerve, and one of them is called OCT, optical coherence tomography. It's a special visualization of the thickness of layers in the back of the eye, including the unmyelinated axons that come together to form the optic nerve. And if that optic nerve is thin, that may reflect prior damage from inflammation related to multiple sclerosis, even if a patient is not aware that they had prior inflammation there. So as a result, inter-eye difference became a very important marker of measuring prior disease activity. And the inter-eye RNFL difference for adults was incorporated into the 2024 update to the McDonald criteria. This presentation that we're talking about today is an update of that same concept, but for a pediatric onset MS population.
Very, very interesting. And I know obviously this 2024 diagnostic criteria are pretty significant to say the least. A lot of big changes that were incorporated, a lot of cool biomarkers that we're starting to see and look at now, CVS, and obviously paramagnetic rim lesions and things of that sort. So, you know, for our clinical audience, provide a little bit of a breakdown and give more insights on the actual the data that you've observed and kind of how we got to the conclusion about this being a biomarker for pediatric onset MS.
So the background is that in adults, this has been validated across a multi-institutional, multi-ethnic, international cohort of individuals that had data obtained through something called the IMS Visual Consortium, which is a consortium related of MS clinicians interested in vision in MS. And the study that we presented here at AAN 2026 was a single center study looking at individuals with pediatric onset MS. It's a rarer condition than an adult onset MS. So the group was broken down, actually came out pretty evenly in our data, to 20 individuals who had known history of optic neuritis, 20 individuals without known history of optic neuritis. And then we used receiver operating curve statistics to characterize what would be the optimal inter-eye difference between the two eyes and RNFL thickness to characterize a prior episode of optic neuritis, even if it was asymptomatic. And that turned out to be 4 micron inter-eye difference, which viewers may be aware is slightly different than the adult onset MS inter-eye difference, which is incorporated into the McDonald criteria, which are either 5 or 6, depending on the platform that is used for obtaining OCT data. And that could reflect the fact that pediatric onset MS occurs in pediatric patients, and younger individuals may have different structural characteristics of their optic nerve. I also want to add one caveat, which is that we actually do not have at this point normative data for OCT in pediatric populations. So we do in adults. In children, that has not yet been fully worked out from the scientific standpoint. So there's some more work to do in this space in the future.
Really, really awesome. I was going to ask you kind of next, what are kind of the implications of data like this? Because like you mentioned, you know, we really haven't gotten a lot of very scarce data for the pediatric side of things, more been focused on the adult side of things. So what are kind of the implications of this data and what are some of maybe the downstream effects that we might see from it?
All right. So the implications are many. Oftentimes, it's really important to get an accurate diagnosis. The audience may be aware that in demyelinating disease, one of the more common things we see in children is actually not MS, but a cousin of MS called MOGAD, myelin oligodendroprotein antibody disease. And that's an important thing for us to consider and to rule out. We are very fortunate to work with a group of pediatric MS clinicians at NYU that has a large cohort of individuals with verified pediatric onset MS. And so we are confident in their accurate diagnosis. And the implications for this are many, including that if an individual comes in, they have perhaps a borderline case of diagnosis of MS where they have some features of it radiographically, may not have had a clear history of optic neuritis in the past, that we can use this OCT technology to help us verify that the optic nerve has been involved. I also just want to take a moment to comment on OCT as a technology because some folks may worry that in a pediatric population, the quality of the data may be lower. In fact, a lot of kids have to get sedated for MRI or have to get braces removed, like oral dental hardware, for MRI to be performed. OCT is a wonderful technology in that it's simple, easy to obtain, essentially the same no matter where it's obtained, as long as it's on the same platform, and very reliable. And I've had children as young as 6 in my clinical practice be able to participate in OCT with high quality data. And we verified that the data were high quality using a kind of OCT criteria called OSCAR-IB, which is the verified criteria for MS-related OCT quality.
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Dr. Grossman to keep you up to date on the latest developments in neurology. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you may have missed since our last episode. First, on April 30th, the FDA approved Axsome's AXS-05 as a new treatment for agitation in patients with dementia due to Alzheimer's disease. Marketed as Auvelity, it becomes the second FDA-approved treatment specific to treat agitation symptoms in patients with AD behind brexpiprazole. Days later, on May 8th, the FDA approved ocrelizumab for the treatment of relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis in pediatric patients aged 10 years and older. With the decision, ocrelizumab becomes an FDA-approved treatment option for pediatric RMS, a group that accounts for an estimated 3 to 5% globally. And lastly, on May 8th, the FDA approved an expanded indication for Argenx's efgartigimod to include adults with seronegative generalized myasthenia gravis. The decision was considered notable as efgartigimod became the first approved therapy for this population and the first for all forms of GMG. For more information about these stories, head to neurologylive.com or you can check out the corresponding link in the show notes. And now, back to our conversation with Dr. Grossman.
Ah, that's really, really awesome to say the least. So you kind of mentioned there for a second about, you know, how easy OCT is to use, which, you know, one of my questions that I had already was kind of the feasibility for this type of biomarker and how it would potentially be incorporated into clinical practice and clinical care. So just speak a little bit about how, you know, we can kind of take what we learned from this study, really incorporate that into real world practice.
Of course, you know, OCT may not be, as of 2026, a standard diagnostic tool for many neurologists. I will say that I think it could be, and in some ways I think it should be, at least for those individuals who have a responsibility for caring with individuals that have a visual consequence of their neurologic process. And that's certainly the case in MS. Some MS divisions around the country have an OCT machine that's within their MS clinic, and the MS doctors are the ones who interpret and, you know, understand the test and document it for the medical record. We are a neuro-ophthalmology division that's based predominantly in a neurology department, so we have an OCT machine, and that's actually been a major upside and opportunity for us to capture data on the structure of the back of the eye in individuals with MS and pursue work like this, including in a rare condition like pediatric onset MS. And so to your question, you know, I think that the opportunities are many. MS is, or OCT is relatively cheap, relatively easy to use, and it can live with us in neurology, as long as we get comfortable with the interpretation of it, which I think would actually not be that challenging for many practicing neurologists.
Well, that's also obviously very good. We, you know, sometimes these ideas seem fantastic and then we talk about how feasible they are in real world life. And then sometimes the conversation gets a little bit skewed from there. So I'm glad to hear that it's very translational to real world practice and things of that sort. Dr. Grossman, great insights from you. I have one last quick question for you. Obviously, this seems like a passion project of yourself and seems like something that we'd want to build on a little bit more. So what other types of research, or where do we kind of go from here afterwards? How do we kind of continue to advance the conversation?
Great. Thanks so much. You know, I also want to give a shout out to all the co-authors who put forward this work, including our medical student, Josh Rodriguez, who was first author and presenting here at AAN, you know, his senior author colleagues, Rachel Kenny, Laura Balser, and Steve Galletta, who are all within the neuro-ophthalmology division with me at NYU. There's a lot of opportunities for the future. I could go on for a long time, but I'll limit them to the following. We're interested in pursuing an understanding of what normative data shows across a population with ophthalmic comorbidities for inter-eye difference in OCT in adults and in children. And we're working with a couple large databases that have captured OCT across a broad population that's well-characterized, that has information about ophthalmic and neurologic comorbidities, and can let us know what is the inter-eye difference that is present in the general population, including as we get older, and there may be ophthalmic comorbidities like glaucoma, or other optic neuropathies that could lead to an inter-eye asymmetry. And that's really an important point, is that we have to take this inter-eye asymmetry in the clinical context of MS and visual symptoms. Another really exciting development is that OCT is currently, commercially available. OCT has a resolution of about 3 to 5 microns. So it's a very small amount of space that's being able to be visualized by OCT, but there is a novel technology that is being presented by my co-authors next week out in California at ARVO, which is called visible light OCT, which is a different spectrum of light incorporated into a proprietary OCT machine and will have a resolution of about 1 micron. It will give us even more information about different layers of the retina, including the retinal nerve fiber layer, but also the cell bodies in the retina, what's called the ganglion cell interplexiform layer, and that's more analogous to the gray matter in the brain. Whereas the RNFL is more like the white matter in the brain. So I think there are a lot of opportunities with visible light OCT, a lot of opportunities to define inter-eye difference in a broader population. And finally, we really aim to gather data about normative pediatric patients and OCT value in the general pediatric population. And I think there are opportunities for that in the future too.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.